What?
Have you ever interviewed Wright?
Yes, I haven't, but he's been interviewed.
But he has been interviewed?
Yes.
Yeah.
And somebody from Cornell is now doing it.
Oh, there's a guy, that's right. There's a sociologist of science who's building his whole career around Sewell. Yeah.
Excuse me, this is tape two of the interview with Robert Hauser. Go on.
The Wright had, I think, originally before 1920, developed a kind of a combination of statistical and graphic methods for representing systems or relationships among variables that he first developed when he was working for the agricultural department and elaborated in various ways over the years under the rubric of path analysis. And Wright, my impression is, was never one, either in this area or in others, to publicize his work. And it kept getting lost. For example, my understanding is that he was a great friend during his tenure at the University of Chicago, both with William Ogburn, who was a great social statistician and one of Dudley Duncan's teachers, and also with, oh my gosh, what's his name? I can't recall the guy's name now. Anyway, one of the great economists at Chicago who was also, did some fundamental work in econometric methods. He was a great friend of both of these guys, but they never paid any attention to Wright's statistical work, never picked up on it, and ended up reinventing both of them, things that he had already done years earlier. In any event, the Blau-Duncan thing, I think partly because the subject matter was very interesting and appealing, at least at the time, and the way in which they wrote about it was reasonably accessible, just ended up making a tremendous impact in the field. So, and I did somewhere in that period, I was in Dudley Duncan's seminar in social stratification, and I started to learn something about path analysis. Actually, I remember doing my paper for the course actually didn't use path analysis at all. It used some non-metric scaling method that Louis Gutman had been working on at the time. But to attempt to induce metric properties of an occupational status hierarchy from relations between occupations that one could measure in terms of the amounts of mobility between them. And so it had nothing to do with this path analysis stuff. Something closely related to that did end up in Dudley's book. Which taught me a lesson at the time. It was one of these somewhat ambiguous things because there are people around who think that I remember being told years later who thought that Dudley stole things from him. And I never felt that at the time. And my impression then and now is that he fed people things and then let them work them out for themselves so that what was mine because I had, you know, because I had done a certain amount of stuff and what made me interesting to him was the fact that he could drop a hint and I would work hard enough at it to develop it and get something out of it. But it was something he was already doing for himself and had thought out. And that's a good way to teach people at the graduate level. But it ends up creating some ambiguity about what people have done that people don't always resolve in an appropriate way. In any event, that was my involvement on the fringes of that work was interesting. And then Dudley was involved in some kind of an advisor, methodological advisor, or some kind of an oversight board or something, in the research that Jim Coleman and Ernest Campbell were doing under a mandate from the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to study inequality of educational opportunity in American public schools. And they produced a massive report called Equality of Educational Opportunity, which showed some things about American schools that were utterly contrary to what everybody had thought about them. They showed what they had expected to find. I mean, the Supreme Court had declared segregation illegal on the grounds that it was inherently unequal in its effects. But everybody really believed that segregated schools were not separate but equal, but separate but grossly unequal. And what they found in the Coleman report was, first of all, that individual variability in any measure of academic aptitude or achievement or social and economic characteristics was far greater within schools than between schools. People had thought somehow that schools were so highly segregated, not just racially, but in terms of social and economic characteristics and ability levels, that things that policies carried out at the school level could really be expected to have very substantial effects. Equalizing policies or compensatory policies carried out at the school level could be expected to have very substantial effects on outcomes. And yet, once people took a really good look at the situation for the first time, what they discovered is the tremendous range of human variability in practically everything within almost any social context you can imagine. And the second thing that they found out, which was at least equally disconcerting, was that there was much less inequality in resources, in measurable resources, between schools, particularly between black and white, predominantly black and white schools, than anyone had expected. And yet there was at the same time this very substantial disparity in academic ability and achievement between blacks and whites on the order of one standard deviation. So there was this great problem which they, in terms of outcomes that they thought that that they knew about to begin with and turned out to be there. And yet the things that they expected to document that would lead the way to relatively straightforward policy treatments just weren't there. Well, it was very exciting stuff. Nobody expected to see any of this sort of thing. Dudley claimed credit, gave a brown bag about this, I think, shortly before the report was released, and produced a little path model decomposing variants into within and between school components and trying to show how they were created. That I found just terribly exciting. He claimed credit for having suggested to Coleman that he partition variants in school outcomes that way so that people could really see a kind of an upper limit to what degree school-to-school differences rather than inter-individual differences really explained the overall variability in these outcomes that people were interested in. I thought that was pretty exciting. And I asked, and in fact at the time I had already started to do a doctoral thesis. I was doing some preliminary work. I hadn't written a proposal yet, but I was going to do something on changes in industry distributions across county areas in the United States or something like that. And if I'd successfully completed that, I wouldn't be here now.
Was this still part of your original interest in cities and zoning?
Yeah, I was kind of following that up.
Excuse me.
It's an old tape. It could crack on you. Anyway, So I asked if there was something to be done further, some further work to be done along those lines. And his impression was that the data from the Equality of Opportunity Survey were not accessible. That was very good advice. I don't know whether they were accessible or not, but it took people years. They subsequently, there was a lot of reanalysis done. In fact, Jenks and Moynihan edited a whole huge volume of reanalyses of those data, but which, because Coleman's analysis was subject to just all sorts of criticism, and turned out to be essentially sound when it all came out. Those data were huge. They were extremely difficult to work with. They were dirty. Everything possible could have been wrong. That could have been wrong with them was wrong with them. And so I was very lucky not to have been saddled too long with the ambition to work with those data directly. But he mentioned to me that Al Rees had some survey data on high school kids from Nashville, Tennessee, that might be amenable to analysis along the lines that he had described in his talk. So I went to see Al and was kind of set up for this, I think. This is a survey that Rees had carried out mostly in order to get a sample of kids he wanted to study self-reported delinquency, and he wanted to find some real delinquents and interview them in depth. And to do that, he needed to start with a very, very large sample survey in order to begin to locate the kind of people he wanted to find. He ultimately wrote a paper, I mean, to give you the flavor of the work that he was really interested in at the time. He wrote a paper called Peers and Queers, which was a study of youthful male prostitutes in Nashville. But he had done this big school survey in 1957 of all kids, black and white, in Nashville in the metropolitan area. There were about 22,000 cases, a lot of cases in this, I think it was the 6th through 12th grades, something along those lines. And he still had all of the data. Well, he didn't have all of the data, he didn't have the questionnaires, but he had all of the punched cards. There were three decks of punched cards, and they were stored in the Michigan Theater Building, which was the place where the Population Center had been before it got a nice new headquarters on South University Avenue. And the Michigan Theater Building, I think one of the reasons they moved out of it was because the Michigan Theater Building had a leak in the roof. These cards had been flooded, had been through a real flood. And so before I could begin work, I had to resurrect these punched cards. And I spent about half of my dissertation year, or the fourth year that I was at Michigan, working with my wife and with Ruth Sweet, who's Jim Sweet's wife, and was then a sociology graduate student also, working with a card punch machine and a sorter in order to try to unwarp these cards enough so that we could reproduce new copies of them and begin an analysis.
You were confident that you would be able to, I hope.
Yeah, I guess we thought that we could. I don't know why. I certainly wouldn't do it now. In fact, I realized what a horror it was. I went through the job after I got here. Those cards, and it was a nice project for the time. Those cards were once I got here, I tried to put a graduate student to work to try to get that material onto tape. And that was from the days when punch cards were the only medium that people used for data storage. Tapes were just coming in. And what you did was make multiple, very strange kinds of multiple punches on cards in order to cram as much information as you could into every single column of the card. And the effect was that those cards couldn't be read into standard character sets on computers, although they could be sorted, and they couldn't be shipped to tape without a tremendous amount of programming hassle. Now, I had some poor graduate student, I think I ruined her career, working on these cards for close to a year before I finally decided this was just hopeless, it wasn't worth it. And I'd worked on a year cleaning them up, I didn't feel guilty about it at the time, because I had done that kind of scut work too, but it was a terrible mess. The whole technology of doing things was just awful then. I was putting together correlation matrices for subgroups that were defined by cross-classification of sex, by race, by grade level, and I don't remember exactly how many variables, maybe 8 or 10 variables that I was working with within each of those subgroups. And for every pair of relationships between variables, I had to make a separate pass through the Michigan computer, which involved carrying all of the cards for that subgroup from the Population Study Center about 4 blocks over to the Michigan Computing Center and waiting 3 or 4 days to see if the job was completed successfully. And I was building up these moment matrices just one element at a time. Now if we had a job like that, we just, you know, it would be a half a day's work if the data were in decent order. I mean, people still have to work a lot to take care of social data, but it was remarkably more difficult then. The tools were just terribly primitive to handle data of that size. Anyway, so by the time I had really, before I had really gotten started on my analysis, because of all the problems that we had with the cards, my dissertation year at Michigan was over and I had to take a job. At that time, I want to say more about the thesis in terms of content, but anyway, at that time, there was a real great market for new entrants in the field. And people were getting all sorts of calls. But I didn't have any publications. I hadn't worked with anybody. And my thesis was not very far along at all. And I was not terribly high on people's lists. At the time, the Tuple were two institutions that offered everybody in my cohort a job. The University of Hawaii, and the deal was with Hawaii was they wouldn't interview you, but they would give you a one-way ticket. And the University of Georgia, and they would interview you. And then everybody else was getting and the other thing is that in my cohort there, most people aspire to come here. There are these interesting feeder relationships between schools, and it was just very clear. Michigan would feed Wisconsin, but Wisconsin graduates were not good enough to go to Michigan. In fact, I don't recall that Michigan ever hired any in that era from this department. And there's a similar relationship now between Wisconsin and Indiana. Tremendous number of the people in the Indiana sociology department, which is quite respectable, are our graduates, and yet we do interview and look at the Indiana graduates, but almost never hire them. One or two people I can remember are hiring from there have not done well. So there are these asymmetric relationships. Anyway, everybody wanted to come to Wisconsin. And in fact, Larry Bumpus did, and Jim Sweet did. and then I got a call from...
Before you did.
Before I did, yeah. They came, and actually Larry didn't come that... Actually, Larry actually came here after I did. Jim Sweet did, but there were some other people not in demography. A guy named Ed Silva was called before I was. He never made tenure. I can't remember. There might have to be somebody else, because I think there were maybe three people who were called up. Wisconsin was hiring a lot of people that year, mm-hmm. too. Darn if I can remember who else. Maybe Shalom Schwartz. Well, he may have been a little earlier than that. I'm not absolutely sure. Andy Mishner. That's the other one, social psychologist. He's still here. So at least Jim and Ed Silva and Andy Mishner were hired, and I never I never heard from Wisconsin.
So it was you said it was an advantage to you that you weren't working with anybody. You said you
well,
were
it was in a it was very nice in
while
the sense
you were
that
there.
I had complete freedom. On the other hand,
but
I had
later
complete freedom
it didn't
to do nothing, and I didn't have a lot to show concretely. For what I had done. I mean, I'd done some papers. I guess somewhere along the line, I forgot. I remember I did a paper for Phil Converse out of it. My first Detroit area study experience. That was my first contact with him. I've dealt with him a lot professionally since then. I always dealt with people at a distance. I mean, I always argue with graduate students that they should apprentice themselves to somebody because that's how they really learn to do things. Mm-hmm. I managed to learn a few things in graduate school in spite of the fact that that isn't what I did. I really did it the hard way. So I had a lot of freedom, but I didn't really know what to do with it.
But from their point of view, it was because they thought you were so good.
They thought that I was so good. Yeah, we do that to people here, too. I mean,
and nobody said you ought to publish, you ought to get some things published.
No. Well, at that time, it was... I think the pressure to publish while you were still in graduate school was not as great as it is now. Now we look at job candidates, and I find it embarrassing because we turn people down who I think would have been promoted. I mean, who have records that are better than the one on which I was promoted, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned. And there's a lot of pressure on people to publish while they're still in graduate school, but I didn't feel that the market was so good then. But it wasn't quite good enough at that time. I ended up getting a call from Brown and went to interview there. And they offered me a job. They put me under a 1 week deadline to respond. It was the only offer that I, from any place interesting that I had. And so I said yes. And the beginning of the next week, Russ Middleton called me and asked me if I wanted to come to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And so I talked to Dudley, and he said, "You can't. You've already given your verbal agreement to go to Brown, you got to go to Brown." So I did. Now, it turned out that in some ways, that worked out well for me in the short run, because I still had most of my thesis to do. Brown's sociology department, as it turned out, had a new little IBM computer that it was operating on an open shop basis. And I continued to do my thesis research using that little machine. To which I had unlimited access. It would have been far more difficult to do my thesis research here at the time.
Hmm.
And I guess my wife continued to help me work on the thesis, and there was a graduate student at Michigan, Roy Cass, who left that program and came to Brown at the same time I did, and he worked for me and with me and helped me. He was one of these guys who was just extraordinarily good at computing, and so he helped me get through somehow. Now that was the best, in some ways, that period in my first year and a half at Brown was the best, the period of my best contact with Dudley Duncan. I didn't go to Michigan, I don't think, at all during that period. But I was far enough along on the thesis so that fairly soon after I got to Brown, I started sending him chapters for commentary. And I would get back to just the most lovely, detailed criticism of the stuff I'd written. And I think he began to realize at that point that it was that there was really something there, so he put some real time into it. And I had this great, extremely satisfying correspondence with him.
Which you
during
saved.
That period. Oh yeah, I'm sure I have it all. Now there's another part of the story involving Bill Sewell. I don't know. Well, there's a long relationship between, how should I put it? One of the reasons I ended up getting introduced to Dudley Duncan, and I guess that he looked on me favorably, is because my uncle probably said some kind words about him. Dudley had been a graduate student at Chicago after the war, and after a brief stint at Penn State, came back and was in the Department of Sociology and was also in Phil's Population Research and Training Center with his wife Beverly. And at some point, I'm not sure exactly what the timing was, Dudley was denied tenure at Chicago. Phil got very angry. He was a real power in the university, and he had Dudley named professor of human ecology in the Population Research and Training Center, so he was his own professor there, but not in the sociology department. And he continued to work there, I guess, must have moved to Michigan about halfway through the time I was an undergraduate at Chicago. But there was also a connection between Dudley and Bill Sewell. Dudley's father, Otis Durant Duncan, was a rural sociologist. He was 12 years older, he's now dead, but he was 12 years older than Bill Sewell. But they were graduate students at about the same time at the University of Minnesota when Bill Sewell first started his training there. Mm-hmm. The elder Duncan, I think, had started out as a school teacher and was quite old relative to others when he had entered graduate school, and was told to leave. He was told that he wasn't good enough to take prelims. But he and Sewell, meanwhile, had struck up a relationship. And then the older Duncan took a job, must have had a master's degree, I guess, and took a job as chairman of the Department of Sociology at Oklahoma A&M in Stillwater, and offered Bill Sewell his first academic job there. Mm-hmm. So and I think the Sewells and Duncans were neighbors. Dudley used to babysit for Sewell's kids, and there was the same age gap between Sewell and the younger Duncan as between Sewell and the older Duncan, 12 years. In any event, Bill Sewell, during the second year that I was at Brown, that must have been 68-69, was spending the year at Russell Sage Foundation. That was the year after he was chancellor here, when all hell had broken loose, and he was going there to rest up and nurse his wounds and decide what he was going to do next. And what he was most interested in doing was coming back here and continuing his research with this cohort of Wisconsin kids.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Sure.
Side two.
By that time, I had decided that I was really quite ready to leave Brown. I had just about finished my thesis. It was dated 1968, but in fact I didn't have my oral until the January of 69. And Dudley, I think, was satisfied that the thesis was really going to be a good one. And so he was ready to write nicer letters about me, I suppose. So he introduced me to Bill Sewell. And I guess I think Sewell must have come. I know that Sewell came through Ann Arbor while I was a graduate student there, but I was never introduced to him. He was this great important figure from the University of Wisconsin who came to visit Dudley and I knew this. I sort of knew who he was, but I was never introduced to him. I was too far down on the totem pole. Mm. So the first time I met him was he invited me to come down from Providence, Rhode Island, to visit his office in the Russell Sage Foundation and have a talk with him. And, apparently that talk went satisfactorily, because shortly after that, Wisconsin invited me out for a visit. I decided that I really liked the place. I keep talking about things that turned me on or didn't turn me on. And I don't remember really liking any place very much until I came here.
City, you mean? Or
no,
university?
No, the university. Hmm. The university. Brown was one of these places which is not so badly rated. That's an outstanding undergraduate school and has a pretty decently rated sociology department as far as that's concerned. But it's a place where people are basically afraid of their own shadows, afraid of being exposed, afraid of criticism. And it's very funny because the people there, many of the people there are really quite good and would deal very effectively with peers elsewhere. But they were always afraid that they would, that their warts would show if they really talked with their colleagues. And I found that terribly uncomfortable once I realized that I really wanted to talk to people and had things to talk about and was interested in what other people were doing. One of the jobs I had while I was there was to organize a series of brown bag lunches, luncheon seminars. And I think those had been scheduled for once a month or something like that, if at all, previously. And so I got those going and I started quizzing people publicly and having a great time trying to find out what they were doing and why and how to do things better, that sort of thing. And then I realized there were many more people doing interesting things than I had thought, and so I started increasing the frequency with which I scheduled these things. It was finally up to once a week when I was called into the chairman's office and said, "Stop. People are getting frightened. We can't do this too often."
These are people on tenure?
Yeah, yeah. And I was really fed up. And then I came here.
Do you think this is characteristic of small colleges, relatively small, or what?
Yeah, I think it is. I think, I don't really know, because I've not been at that many places, but my guess is that it is, yeah. In a place like Brown, at least, it's very sad, because the place was better than that,
yeah.
Really. And would have been better yet if people did talk to one another.
And this was a well-established practice at Michigan, was it? That people
Yeah, and at Michigan, it was that kind of thing was done. It was almost enforced that one talked to one's colleagues. It was, you had to whether you wanted to or not. There was the populations. It was expected that people would go to do their research at the office at the Population Study Center in Michigan. You did not work at home unless you had something you really had to do that required you being at the library. You didn't work at the library, you would go to the office and you would work. That was a practice that the Duncans brought with them at Chicago. And at 10 o'clock in the morning and 3 o'clock in the afternoon, there was a 20-minute coffee break. You were not allowed to have coffee at your desk. Then or at any other time, you don't drink coffee while you work. You went to the commons room at the coffee hour and you sat and you talked about what you were doing. And that was the rule and that was it. There were people who would rather deliberately talk about sports or, you know, I mean they would, but it was clear that they were violating a norm that the Duncans and Ron Friedman, I think, also were trying to create. Not all of the faculty agreed with that, but that's the way they were trying to structure the situation. They really wanted to mold serious professionals, and they thought this was the way to do it. the the other thing that they did, that we do here too, we don't do that here. But the other thing that they did that we do is to have these brown bag seminars constantly. And we were required as a condition of our partial support by the population center there to come to the population and I think also the family planning seminars, and there were weekly seminars in each of those areas, and you were expected to show up and listen even if it had absolutely nothing to do with your interests or with your current research or anything of that sort. And when you had something to talk about, you were expected to present it, again, whether or not it had, you know, anything directly to do with your program. But it was, the idea was that everybody there was at some level a professional scholar and expected to perform as such at all times. We aren't quite as rigid about attendance, and maybe we should be more rigid. I'm not sure, but anyway, we aren't as rigid about that as.
You mean you have the seminars, but you...
We have the seminars, and people show up, and this place is so huge that there's almost always a pretty good crowd, and so you don't have to, you never get embarrassed. And it's people's tough luck if they don't want to show up. We're more permissive. Where was I?
You've been invited here by Bill Sewell, and you hadn't liked Brown.
You
were fed up with Brown.
Right. Oh, yes. And the neat thing about coming here was that I came and I talked about some aspect of my thesis, I guess, that I had just completed. And people were jumping all over me and saying all sorts of nasty things. And I had a great time defending myself. And I thought, gee, this is great fun. It was clear that people were paying attention to what I was saying. And I thought it was, I think it was just great. Still is for the most part. So I came here at the time. I should say, to make this story complete, I had this love-hate relationship with the University of Chicago, and I was actually looking at a job there at exactly the same time. Made one trip to the Midwest and stopped at both places.
Was it your uncle who had offered you the job? Or?
Well, he was no longer, not directly, no, but he was no longer chairman. Maury Janowitz, I think, was chair then. You know, it was clear that I was, at that point, that I was going somewhere.
What was it clear from?
Interested. I think because the thesis was clearly...
But you hadn't published
was
it
clearly
yet.
Great. No, I hadn't published it yet. What did I have at that time to show for myself? Probably all I had was Dudley Duncan's word and such copies of it as I passed out to these people when I was in the job market. I don't think that, as of that point, I still don't think I had any publications. My first ever publication was, I think, in July of 1968. Oh, so maybe I did have one paper by then. One paper. Is that right? Is that
certainly
right?
Check.
Or it may have been 69. No, that doesn't sound right. So it must have been July of 69. Whoops, I can't walk around with this on. We do have a copy of this.
Yeah.
Must be roughly chronological. It's the American Journal of Sociology. May of 1969. Mm-hmm. I don't remember this anymore.
American Journal of Sociology.
Yes. And that was a piece of, or kind of a summary of my thesis, a digest or something like that. So that's all there was to go on. I must have had, And I came here in July, which meant that it was basically on the basis of a manuscript. Actually, there were two manuscripts, plus the thesis on which I was hired here in Chicago.
You mean you had two other articles?
Well, this one article that we've just been talking about was one of them. And there was another one that was a joke. I may not have been very productive, but I was very disrespectful up until that point. There was, aside from this issue of schools and school and social inequality and social policy that had motivated the Coleman Report and my reactions to it, there was another issue, related issue, that was of more general interest in sociology at the time, involving the effects of social, what they call the effects of social contexts, of which schools were only one case, but a particularly interesting case. And the notion that people had was that, for example, in the case of schools, was that there was a social climate created by the presence of a particular sort of student in terms of ability or ambition or social background, and that this had an effect independent of one's own ambition or ability or social background on one or another outcome. And this was something that Peter Blau had helped to introduce. And in effect, what he said was that if you could find effects like this, that was real sociology. Group effects are real sociology. Individual characteristics aren't real sociology. It's a very silly kind of argument, in my opinion. But one which a lot of people find terribly appealing. They want to cut out to be able to claim some particular observable is what sociology is really all about, which I think is just silly. Anyway, Peter Blau was involved in that. You mentioned sociologists at work before. The contribution to that from Jim Davis, who is small groups and great books, but yeah. Something about that. I'm almost sure that there was some reference in that discussion to the stuff that he was interested in social composition. He wrote a paper with Joe Spaeth and Carolyn Hewson. It was some kind of a methodological paper on effects of this kind that grew out of that same project. People were very, very enamored of this. And the horrible thing about it is that the less you invest in your explanation in terms of building a model that's reasonably adequate, that includes all the variables you want to have in it, the easier it is to find effects of this kind. So it's very easy to do, and the journals were filling up with all kinds of examples of this sort. So that was part of the larger context in which I was doing this thesis research. There was this notion that if you came from a school with ambitious kids, you were going to be more ambitious. That was the general idea. The problem is that you're more likely to find an effect like that if you don't control for the other variables that are also likely to affect ambition. And it's a very simple thing to say, but people just weren't paying any attention to that. Then part of this has partly to do with my nasty history at Brown. There was another guy on the faculty there who had completed his thesis in 3 months, whereas I took the 3 months before he took his job, whereas I had taken a year and a half to do it. And it was a pretty crummy thesis. But Brown wouldn't let you teach graduate students until you had your doctorate.
Oh.
And so I was sitting there working away at my thesis, and teaching only undergraduates because I wasn't allowed to teach graduate students because I hadn't completed my doctorate. And here was this guy for whom I did not have a lot of respect, who was teaching the graduate methods course. The students were in my opinion, more discerning. They wanted me to start a revolution and try to get to teach it, and I said I wouldn't touch that idea. But then I saw a copy of his final exam, in which he asked a question to which it was obvious on this very topic, to which it was obvious that the right answer he wanted was, in my opinion, the wrong answer. And at that point, I really got burned up. So I was toying around with all sorts of data that were appropriate to this at the time. And over a weekend, I scratched out a paper called Context and Concepts, which was a parody of how to do this sort of analysis, which showed that, and should demonstrate empirically, that men's ambitions for schooling, high school boys' ambitions for later schooling were lower if they attended schools with a lot of girls. And I wrote this all up with the utmost seriousness and ended up with prescriptions that, you know, sexes should be segregated in schools and probably women's schooling could be postponed until after they completed childbearing and all sorts of utter nonsense like this. And I sent it off to Dudley. And he just thought it was terribly funny. So that improved my standing with him. And he said he thought I should try to publish it. I did. I sent it here, actually. At the time, Norman Ryder was in this department and was the editor of the American Sociological Review. That was here. And he sent me back a letter which said that I was wasting the time of serious scholars, that this was an utter insult to the intelligence of everybody, and so on and so forth. Had absolutely no sense of humor about it at all. It turned out, I learned many years later, that it had been reviewed by a guy who had been the research associate of Bill Sewell at the time, who was a pretty decent graduate student, but an incredibly good, incredibly hard-working fellow, but was not very imaginative or original or anything. And he had read this thing through with great care, and then at the end of it, I said, "Of course, this is all nonsense." He was really insulted. He had tried to give me all this help, taking me terribly seriously all the way through this mess, and then ended up just feeling that he'd really been taken for a ride and very angry about it. That did me no good here or with ASR, but then Dudley suggested that I send it to Bill Hodge, Robert Hodge, I mentioned earlier, same guy, real name's Robert, who was then at the University of Chicago. The people at Chicago have special rights with respect to the American Journal of Sociology. And Hodge just signed off. I thought it was terribly funny, and he signed off on it, so they ended up publishing. I hope none of our feminist graduate students end up looking back at that or reading it wrong way.
Did you put an end to small group theory?
I put an end to that. Anybody who writes that kind of stuff, has had to make stronger claims for the quality of the model with which they're working. They have to claim. I think they have to understand that they need to make a stronger claim to the effect that they have controlled other factors than was customary then. So it's something that was designed to try to make people honest, and not necessarily perfect, but honest. And I think it's worked reasonably. well. That digest of my thesis, the thesis itself, and this one paper were the things which I was carrying into the market.
He can't have endeared you to Norm Ryder here.
Yeah. He forgave me after a few years, told me that he did anyway. The other thing was, and I'm not sure exactly at what stage of the game this became known, but the Sociological Association was given a bequest by Arnold Rose and his wife to create a monograph series to be sponsored by the association, which they had never had up to that point. And the first editor of the series turned out to be Albert J. Reese, Jr. And Al solicited my thesis for that series. And I spent most of the first year that I was here, 69-70, reworking that for publication. Mm. And once, almost in its entirety, that made in a more serious way the same kind of argument that I just described in this parody. The gist of the argument was that, first of all, there is not a great deal of variability between schools in academic or non-academic outcomes of secondary schooling relative to individual variability. And that much of that can be explained by the individual variables that we can identify and measure, and that to the extent we can't explain it in terms of those variables, how should I put it? The argument was that the statistical models of effects of individual variables that we were looking at really weren't good enough, so that the argument had, in some sense, had to be left hanging, and I was able to develop some ways of showing empirically that the models that I was using and others were typically using to explain academic and motivational outcomes of schooling just weren't good enough, so that one shouldn't be surprised that you could not account for differences among schools in these outcomes when we didn't have very good models of individual inter-individual differences to begin with. So that was the gist of that. Where are we?
Well, we're almost at the end of this tape.
We're almost at the end of the tape. Yeah. Not sure where I should go from there. I guess I really haven't said much about the real Wisconsin part of all of this yet.
Will you be able to take the time to do?
Sure, I'm enjoying this, especially if I can get a copy of the tapes at some stage of the game.
Of course.
That'd be fun.
They're not transcribed unless we can get some.
A copy of them would be fun to have. Maybe force my kids to listen to them sometime.
Well, I'm just curious. When you came here with the Wisconsin Longitudinal Survey study existed, did you expect to be able to use that as?
Oh, absolutely.
As a sufficient?
I was really brought here to work on that. At the time, Sewell had a half-time position with enough money for a junior faculty member. And the deal was, when I came here, that I would have half-time for research, half-time teaching, true half-time in terms of budgeting. That is to say, I would teach one course a semester. Mm-hmm. And I was continued to be supported that way for several years. I don't know exactly when that stopped, I was clearly brought here to work on that. Bill had very more than adequate support for the project, but he never really had a younger person on the project up to that point who had as much independence as he wanted to see. in a colleague. He wanted to be able to work with somebody, but he didn't want to work with somebody who would just do exactly what he would have done himself. He really wanted.
And that's what he was after when he interviewed.
He really wanted
you.
Something more. Yeah, yeah, that's what he was looking for. Now at that time, he had in the not too distant past, he had completed this extraordinarily successful follow-up of the that he had carried out through the parents in 1964, and he had also collected earnings data for young men through, I think, 1967. And there were several different people working on the project with him, but he just wasn't satisfied with what was happening.
Okay.